From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
For a lot of us gardeners, our connection to birds perhaps started with, or maybe even still centers on, putting up the bird feeder. Today's guest, Catherine Schneider, wants to nudge us to move from bird watcher to birder, and her new book tells us how. But first, this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Catherine Schneider is past president of the New York State Ornithological Association, has directed New York's Natural Heritage Program, and conducted bird surveys for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Her new book is Birding the Hudson Valley. And she's also one of us, a gardener, and I'm glad to welcome her today to the show. Hi, Catherine. How are you?
I'm fine. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. Well, congratulations on the new book. I was so glad to find it at my local bookstore. And it's so much more than the title even lets on, isn't it?
Well, I hope so.
And it's a labor of love, obviously, from a life that has been enriched by birds. You've been loving birds a long time, yes?
Yes, I grew up in a family that was very interested in nature. My mom was a bird watcher, and I guess I started my formal interest in birds when I was in college, but I've been birding a long time.
Mm. Well, I mean, in the book, you do give us sort of the how-to for feeding birds and the safety tips for their safety. I mean, where to sight feeders and where not to and what seed has the widest appeal. You give us those things, but then you quickly say, and I quote, "Bird feeders attract only a limited clientele." And that's the truth, huh?
Yeah, there's some birds you'll just never see at a bird feeder. If you want to see more interesting birds, you need to move beyond the feeder.
Yeah. And so I guess that's sort of the beginning of the invocation to go from bird watcher, you know, at the winter windowsill to a person with binoculars. Yeah, a birder, huh?
Yeah, I'm often surprised how many people that watch birds at a feeder don't even use binoculars.
Oh.
And you can even learn more about birds with binoculars at a feeder. But going out and going birding will get you into much more interesting things for birds.
So you open the book with a sort of brief geological history of the area where you and I both live, but this would be true whatever region this book was about, which we're in the Hudson Valley of New York. And what does the geological history of a place, any place, have to do with birding, with birds? Why'd
you
do that?
Well, I was trying to sort of set the stage for the world in which birds live.
Yeah.
And the Hudson Valley is not natural anymore. It's been inhabited for more than 400 years by human beings, and we've changed it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I want people to understand that, or to try and get a picture of what the Hudson Valley might have been like before man was here, and see how the birds might have evolved in that kind of a situation, and how the things we did to change the Hudson Valley would affect the distribution of birds.
Mm. It was very interesting. I had never, you know, I didn't expect it, and yet I didn't know much of it. So it was very, very helpful and provocative, really. And it's funny that one of the other things you say in the book is find the food, find the bird. And again, there you don't mean put up the bird feeder and look out the window, right?
No, I'm just always struck by birds. Birds are finely tuned machines. They are energetically, flying is a very energetically expensive way to get around. So they need a lot of food to fuel their high metabolism. So food is really important, and food drives most of what birds do. There's a seasonality to their cycle. They can't, for example, replace their feathers and nest at the same time because those are energetically expensive things to do. So food is critical, and especially in winter, So if you know where they're actually finding food, then you can often find birds. And so it pays to pay attention to what they're eating.
So right now, where you and I live in the Northeast, we're in fall. Well, everywhere, I guess, you know, in this hemisphere is in fall. And so what's going on? What kind of food stuff? Some birds are still moving through, migrating. Others are coming to their winter haunts, I guess. What's kind of the food that they're following. What's going on now?
Well, the insects are starting to wind down. During the breeding season, birds need insects. They feed, insects are high in protein, so they feed their babies insects. Mm. But the adults often eat other things. And now that the babies are out of the nest, they're turning to things like fruits, for example. The fruits are ripening. And they, many of the birds that are passage migrants, ones that are going through here now, are stripping the plants of things like dogwood berries and sumac and cherries and grapes. Those are the first foods to get eaten. And then as the season goes on, there's seeds that are available, and many of the sparrows eat seeds, and so those kinds of foods are being eaten. And then even later, some of the more durable fruits, like poison ivy berries, for example, which are a favorite, and things like crab apples, for example.
Yeah.
Crab apples actually improve in quality after they've frozen a few times. So some of the later things come and see the birds all the way through the winter.
Mm. And so, of course, that's why, like in my garden where I have a lot of crab apples and I have a lot of winterberry hollies and certain types of fruits, why I see birds that are attracted to those specific things at particular times. I mean, it's sometimes in large numbers. You know, I don't necessarily have big flocks of birds in the garden regularly, but at certain moments, you know, like when the hollies are prime, in
right.
swoops, well, you know who. I don't even have to say guess, because you know who swoops in for things like that, right?
Well, I know cardinals love them, among other things.
They do. The wax wings, they're crazy mm-hmm. for them. Yeah.
Right.
So you just said something about seeds, and I, speaking of finding the food, the last few mornings, October mornings, I've had maybe, I don't know, 7 or 8 white-throated sparrows feeding on a sort of weedy patch of, I don't know, it's not lawn, it's weedy lawn, not far from one window in my house. And there seem to be a lot of sparrows around, sort of, it's almost like suddenly you see a lot of sparrows again as the fall evolves. Is that a thing? Like, why is that?
Well, it definitely is. Sparrows, some of the sparrows are migratory. We have sparrows that are here year-round, but there are sparrows that live north of us that pass through our area on their way farther south for the winter. So white-throats spend their summers on the tops of mountains and farther north from here. They live in generally colder climates. So there's a whole progression of sparrows that come through in the fall. We usually see Lincoln sparrow and Vesper sparrows first, and then the white-throats and the white-crowned sparrows start to come in, and later on juncos, and finally American tree sparrows. So there's a whole progression, and pretty much the white throats, song sparrows are here year-round, at least some of them.
Yeah.
White throats come in and then disappear in the spring when they go back to their breeding grounds. Juncos are here for the winter, but then they also will go back to their breeding grounds. And the tree sparrows come from far, far north, and they're basically replaced by chipping sparrows, which have left already for this winter.
You know, it's funny you said juncos, and I think a lot of people might not know that juncos are a sparrow, yeah?
They're related to sparrows,
yeah.
Yes. The taxonomy of sparrows is really changing almost daily. but they are seed-eating birds, yes.
Yeah, so they're cousins or whatever. And at this time of year in October, I always, being in the Northeast, I'm kind of waiting to see the juncos because I feel like they're the announcement that it is feeder season is almost upon us, you know, is almost upon us, and it's the winter visitors are gonna congregate. Do you know what I mean? They come in bigger numbers. Yeah,
they're just starting to come in now. People are starting to see their very first juncos of the season. But yes, the feeders are filled by white-throated sparrows and juncos most of my winter here.
Yeah. You were saying other sparrows sort of in progression order. Were you talking about, I can't remember now, in the fall or in the spring, the progression that you were saying? Because I think of, for instance, just when the weather's starting to warm up in the spring, I see fox sparrows, which are so distinctive looking. They're like a cinnamony kind of color as opposed to a drabber brown or grayish, you know?
They're among my favorite sparrows. They're so pretty, and in the spring they often sing. We see a lot more in the spring than we do in the fall, but yes, they migrate through on their way north.
And so I see them for a little while and then not again now. So tell us about that, because some birds, you know, a lot of people say, oh, you know, the robins are back. But the robins didn't, like, go to the tropics for the winter. And these sparrows, you know, some of them were talking about migrating, but we're not talking about necessarily tropical migrate. Tell us a little bit, like, resident, partial migrant, migrant. Do you know what I mean? The different sort of...
Yeah. I mean, birds have different strategies for making it through life. I mean, some birds are truly resident. They stay here year-round. Other birds, the populations are partially migratory. So the northern populations might actually pass over us and go farther south because it's too difficult to make it through the winter,
right,
way up in Canada, for example. So sometimes we have partial migrants, and then we have birds that are called neotropical migrants. These are ones that basically clear completely out of our area and go all the way to South America for the winter. These are things like our warblers, for example.
Yes.
Warblers are primarily insect-eating birds, and they just cannot make it through the winter here.
Right.
So they clear out and go all the way south to South America and come back in the spring when food's available.
Right. So there are these different strategies. But when I, for instance, take down the feeders and in around the end of March when Mr. and Mrs. Bear come out and would like to destroy the feeder, when I do that, I may not see so many, for instance, just goldfinches, as I would see in the winter, where I'd see large numbers of them. But that doesn't mean that they've gone to another continent or something, right? I mean,
oh no,
you know?
It's the robins, for example, are here all winter. There
right.
may not be the ones that bred here, but there are robins that are here
right.
all winter. They may be ones from farther north, but they are eating fruit in the woods, and no one sees them much in winter because of that.
Exactly.
I think it's spring when I see a robin on the lawn, because then you know he's looking for worms and the ground is starting to thaw.
Right. You know, back to sparrows just for a second, because I for so many years, I mean, and I'm more of a bird watcher, probably right on the cusp of a birder. You know, I'm an advanced intermediate or something like that. Or I'm not an advanced intermediate. Maybe I'm an intermediate beginner, an advanced beginner. I don't know, something like that. But for many years, I would mark down first on paper in a book and in a notebook, and then eventually, as technology changed, on things like eBird.org, you know, the sort of virtual database spreadsheet that we can put our bird counts in and so forth. And every time I'd see a sparrow, you know, I'd diligently get everybody else as correct as I could. But with sparrows, I'd just sort of say sparrow.
Yeah, little brown jobbers. We call them LBJs.
Little brown
jobbers.
So
I mean, yeah, that is something that to work on. I mean, the sparrows are easily identifiable if you know what to look for and if you know what to expect. There are some immatures, for example, that are more challenging than others,
yes.
But it's worth it to take the time to actually note the field marks and figure out what birds should be in your area at a particular season. That narrows the choices down dramatically.
Yeah, and it was really a good exercise. And by no means can I identify all the ones you named, nor have I seen all the ones you named, but because I tend to do my birding mostly in my garden and in the surrounding area where I live. But what I was able to do was meet maybe five or six kinds for sure. Do you know what I mean? And know
yeah.
who those were. And that gave me like a lesson for how to approach a lot of things, including I was laughing the other day to learn from a botanist friend who visited. I thought I had this one type of goldenrod up in my unmown meadow above my house. And I said, you know, very, you know, expert sounding, I said, well, you know, I have just Canada goldenrod up there with a little blue stem, blah, blah, blah. And I probably used the Latin names. And she went up there, you know, she didn't say a thing. And then she walked up there. And about 5 minutes later, she comes back. She goes, Margaret, you don't have Canada goldenrod, but you have five other species. And
right.
It was the sparrow thing. I'd done the, you know what I mean? I'd called it, quote, goldenrod, like it was a generic thing and not,
mm-hmm.
and not really looked carefully, right?
Right, right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, mm-hmm. Are there favorite birds, groups or birds or species of birds or birds that you've followed in your career, you know, especially?
I have. Everyone always asks me if I have a favorite bird, and I have to say that I go through phases where I like some birds better than others, but I think one thing that's just stayed with me is I've become attached to the birds that I've studied professionally or written papers on, because I feel like I know those birds. I know things about those birds that other people don't know, you know? So I studied red-bellied woodpeckers, and I've studied white-throated sparrows, and I've studied short-eared owls, and did some research on all of these. And white-throated sparrows, they're just little brown birds, but they are fascinating in so many ways. They have dominance hierarchies in winter, and they come in two different forms. They're what we call a polymorphic species. They have two different forms. There are tan-striped birds, and there are white-striped birds.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about these two different forms is that they mate with each other, so that the white-striped males always mate with the tan-striped females and vice versa.
Oh.
And now we even know that the genes that are attached to the stripe, to the white-striped head color, affect their behavior. So, for example, the white-striped birds are slightly more aggressive than the tan-striped birds, and the tan-striped birds do better parental care. So by doing this assortative mating that where they choose the opposite color morph, they actually get the best kind of care for raising their young.
Wow. I didn't know that. Now, I have noted that there are the white-striped and the tan-striped heads, and it befuddles me sometimes when I'm first looking at them and I have to go get my book and look, and you know what I mean? Because I'm like, what's that sparrow? And then I remember that. But I didn't know that it actually correlated to other behavioral traits or whatever.
Yeah, it's amazing what they're finding out these days when they look into the details of polymorphisms.
And red-bellied woodpeckers, I love them. They're just a vivacious kind of and fresh-looking bird when they show up in the winter at the feeder or wherever I see them. Yeah. What about them? Anything?
Well, they're just beautiful birds for starters. But the work that I did with Jeremy Kirkman at the New York State Museum, I took a sabbatical from my teaching responsibilities and worked on red-bellied woodpeckers for a year. And what we found out was that the birds were extending their range.
Oh.
They are actually a southern species, so they've only started to, I mean, they're just getting into Maine now, but they've spread north into New York and become much, much more common over time. And we were looking at the characteristics of the birds that were moving north. Were they larger birds? Were they males? Were they females? Who were the pioneers?
I see.
And we were able to actually track their movement north over a period of time. And this may be related to climate change, but it may be related to their ability to survive the winter as well. So those are the kinds of things we're interested in.
It's funny. I was yesterday just looking up at the sky. There were a lot of turkey vultures moving overhead, and then I saw some black vultures, and I thought, there's another one. You're saying extended its range, a bird that was thought to be a southern, quote-unquote, bird or whatever, and we see more of them, I guess, in recent, I don't know if it's decades or years, but...
Well, certainly they've been moving north in just the last 20 years or so. I think the first breeding records were in New York were only, 25 or 30 years ago. They were very, very rare. But this is interesting because black vultures are generally not migratory. So as they extend their range, they're going to be here in winter, whereas our turkey vultures go south.
I didn't know that.
Part.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Oh, great. Okay, because I love vultures. So I want to take the last, we have 5 minutes or so left, and I really want to, you're very connected to other birders. You don't just do this all alone. And you mention in the book some tactics, whether sort of apps or joining clubs or things like eBird, like I mentioned. When you birders who know one another discover something special, you don't keep a secret, do you? You share it, don't you?
No, birders birding is so much more fun when you share it with other people. So when we find a special bird, we try to let everyone else know so that they can see it too. This is somewhat tied to the listing. Birders like to keep lists of all the birds they've
seen.
Yes,
you do, don't you?
Yeah, we do. We do. We like to keep an inventory. But we share the information. There are bird clubs, there are listservs, there are are apps that people use to share information so that, for example, there's been a scissor-tailed flycatcher that's been hanging out in Gilderland for the last week or so. This is a bird that belongs in Texas or Oklahoma.
Oh.
And it's made its way to New York. They have a history of vagrancy. They turn up in odd places from time to time. But this is a truly beautiful bird. It has a tail almost as long as its body. And, you know, the word went out that bird was there. I went up there yesterday and actually saw it. And other people were there. I met a guy from Long Island who I hadn't seen in 30 years.
Oh.
And he was there, too, to see the scissor-tailed flycatcher. So it was great.
That's great. And so you mentioned apps. Are there any that you, some of us who are working to move from bird watcher to birder, like any that you want to throw out there that we should look at?
Well, I would suggest that people that are interested in learning about more about birds get involved with bird clubs.
Yes.
There are opportunities to go bird watching. There are many, many bird clubs in the Hudson Valley. The Hudson Mohawk Bird Club, the Allen DeVoe Bird Club are around here. And they almost always have field trips where people are welcome, whether they're members of the club or not. This is an opportunity to go bird watching with people who know birds better than you, and that is by far the best way to learn. I owe most of my birding abilities to what other people were willing to teach me.
Mm.
In terms of apps, I would suggest looking at listservs. There are listservs given in my book. These are online mailing lists that will tell you where the birds are. And once you've connected, there are also text messaging services, which are usually run by the local bird clubs. So
right.
Once you get connected to the birding community, there are many, many ways to learn about birds in your area.
Yeah, I mean, I went on a walk with one of the local groups that you mentioned, and I always feel so intimidated, you know, because everybody knows what they're doing, and they're all birding by ear. They're listening, and they're hearing things that we don't even see yet. And but it is, I will say, if we can get over our shyness, those of us who are a little less expert, it is an amazing leap forward. Each time you go, you pick up on some tactic or something, you know, or meet a new bird, I mean, at least.
Yeah, birding by ear is another level of birding, but you can often pick up tips from other birders very easily, and I would choose your season. As the leaves come out on the trees, it becomes necessary to bird by ear because you can't see the birds very easily anymore. You see about 25% or less of what we actually encounter. But birding outside of the leaf season with a bird club is a good way to start.
Well, Catherine, I'm so happy to speak to you. And again, I'm so grateful for the book, selfishly, since I'm here in the Hudson Valley. But it also is an inspiration about how to become a birder, really, for anyone anywhere. So thank you so much for making the time to talk to me.
Oh, you're very welcome. It was fun.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or iTunes. You can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or at facebook.com/awaytogarden or on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening and birding meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.